Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. We last left Elizabeth taking the decision to return to Vienna to revisit her childhood home, the Effrussi Palace on the Ringstrasse corner with Schottengasse. It is a hard decision to take, but on 8th December 1945 she is in Vienna, 6.5 years after she last walked out of her home. As a true intellectual, a book lover, she writes a novel expressing her feelings. This novel has been a precious fount of information for her grandson, Edmund. In her novel, Elizabeth describes the bombed-out railway station, the rapacity of the poor inhabitants of that which had been the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, its ruined landmarks, the opera, the stock exchange, the Academy of Fine Arts. St. Stephen's is a burnt-out shell. The majestic linden trees along the ring are but naked stumps. She bravely approaches her childhood home, wonders what has become of her bedroom, which used to be invaded by the scent of the flowers from the linden trees. Palais Effrussi is now the headquarters of the American Occupying Authority. They have taken over from the Nazis. Motorbikes and jeeps are parked in the courtyard. Most panes of the glazed roof are smashed. Many of the caryatids have collapsed. But in the courtyard, the Apollo is there, on his plinth, paused with his lyre. Over the fireplace in Papa's library hangs a huge map of occupied Vienna, with the Russian, American, and Allied zones marked in different colors. Emmy's portrait is still there, as is Victor's desk. The dining table with its chairs, a secretaire, wardrobes, beds, the vast armchairs. The black vitrine stands there, empty. A kindly Yankee lieutenant understands her wish, and wanting to help, he shows Elizabeth round. He tells her that an old lady still lives there. Her name is Anna. Thank you. can't so. After 8 years, after so long and after so much has happened, they meet again. Elizabeth, now grey-haired, the elder daughter of the Baron and Baroness, and Anna, now an elderly woman, the faithful lady's maid. And finally, Anna can recount her story. On the day Otto Krishna had gone, leaving the palace gates wide open for the Gestapo to come in, Anna was told that she was to be ashamed for having served the Jews. She was to make herself useful and help sort out the belongings of the previous owners. She was made to pack the silver in the silver room. The day Victor and Rudolf were taken away, Anna was roped in to pack away Emmy's jewelry, her coats, the clocks that she had so many times wound, the books so loved by the Baron, the children's toys from the box room. What could she save for her old masters, for Emmy, and for the children? I couldn't take away precious things for you, so I would slip away three or four of the little figurines from the Baroness's dressing room, the little toys that you played with when you were children. I put them in my apron pocket and I took them to my room. I hid them in my mattress. They did not notice. They were too busy with all the grand things. So, the 264 little trinkets, which had shared Charles's room with the yellow armchair, with the Impressionist paintings, the Moreau and the Della Robbia figure in Paris, and had been the children's playthings in Emmy's changing room in Vienna, had never been cared for as much as when they lay in Anna's mattress amongst Austrian horsehair. With their humble guardian, they had survived hunger, looting, fire, and the Russian invasion. To Anna, each of these hardy figurines is a story recalled, a future held onto. Her gift to Elizabeth is precious. Our author was told the story several times by his grandmother and by her brother, his uncle Iggy. Yet he tells us that only on his third visit to the palais did he feel the story. A story, he says, of hiddenness. For the house, he found out, is full of hidden passages, hidden servants' quarters. It is a house of hidden children's toys, hidden games on the parapets above the palais, hide and seek in the tunnels and the cellars, secret drawers in cabinets with lovers' letters to Emmy. But it was also a house of unseen people and unknown lives, people sleeping in airless rooms, tucked between floors. It was a place to hide where you have come from. It was a place to hide things in. And as the wall collects files, letters, and forgotten things, Gestapo files, diaries, journals, he is horrified at what he discovers. The Bassano house on the Golden Hill in Paris has been turned into one of the Nazi detention camps, an annex for the Drancy concentration camp. He finds a note that says that Elizabeth, the sweet girl in the blue dress in Renoir's painting of Louise Caen d'Enfer's daughters, has been deported and died in Auschwitz, as also has Louise's granddaughter Beatrice, her husband Leon Reinach, and their two children, all deported and killed at Auschwitz in 1944. Says the wall, all the venomous diatribes against the Jewish families on that golden hill had their late and appalling flowering in Paris. The Nazi occupied Paris. He cannot help wondering why the Nitzuke should have survived in Anna's pocket, in her mattress, while so many hidden people did not. So important to his family saga, and central as Anna is to recounting his family story, De Waal tells us, I know too much about the traces of my gilded family, but I cannot find out any more about Anna. She is not left money in Emmy's will. There is no will. I do not even know Anna's whole name or what happened to her. I never thought to ask. She was simply Anna. So once again, this time in the mid-1940s, just at the end of the Second World War, the Nitzuke change home. Elizabeth takes them back to her home in England, in her attaché case. She knows she will never return to Vienna again. There were 185,000 Jews in Austria at the time of Anschluss. Only 4,500 returned. 65,500 were killed. Nobody was called to account. Austria rejected reparations because it had been an occupied country between 1938 and 1945. For years, Elizabeth tried to retrieve her family property for herself and for her siblings. But she was to find out that on the list of priorities in the rebuilding of a shattered society, the restitution of property to the rightful owners came near the bottom. Although in 1946 the Republic of Austria passed a law which declared that any transaction that had been making use of Nazi discriminatory ideology was null, Elizabeth found out that enforcing the law was difficult. Besides, any valuable artwork considered significant to Austria's cultural heritage could not be exported. Allow me here a brief interlude. Those of us who have watched the movie Woman in Gold, or who have read the book, will notice that this is exactly the subject treated in the film, or in the book, which recounts the story of Maria Altman, a Jewish refugee who goes on a quest to retrieve Gustav Klimt's painting of her aunt, Adele Bloch-Bauer, which had been confiscated by the Nazis in Vienna.
Gustav Klimt is best known for his golden paintings and portraits of society women in Habsburg Vienna. The Austrian capital had become a cosmopolitan and wealthy imperial city at the turn of the 19th century, and 1 in 10 Viennese inhabitants were Jewish. Well-assimilated Jews living in Vienna at the time included Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, and intellectual Theodor Herzl. Being one of the finest painters in Austria at the time, Klimt was also commissioned to undertake large-scale public paintings, including one to honor Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. In 1897, Klimt became the first president of the Vienna Secession, which was the avant-garde alternative to the formal academy. Klimt was not Jewish, but many of his patrons were. Amongst them was Wittgenstein's sister, the Lederers and the Bloch-Bauers. Klimt's female portraits reflected the wealth and stature of their patrons, but soon acquired an air of risque. Klimt drew his dark-haired women as objects of desire, and his later work is effective at conveying the point where desire, eroticism, and dreams meet in art. Klimt had a fascination with organic patterns and had been formally inspired by the Byzantine mosaics he had seen in Ravenna. He enveloped his female figures in dazzling gold cloaks, whilst also encasing them in a halo of light. The years 1899 to 1910 are considered to be Klimt's golden phase, and many of his works prominently use gold leaf. The works most popularly associated with this phase in the artist's life are the portraits of Adele Bloch-Bauer in 1907 and, of course, the famous Kiss, painted in 1908. Klimt made a series of paintings centered on the theme of the kiss, which was very much a symbolist-inspired theme, and possibly also inspired by Rodin's sculpture of the same name. Adele's story as a Viennese Jewish socialite and her probable relationship with the charismatic artist was recently related in the film The Lady in Gold. Strangely enough, Klimt's work was not banned by Nazi Germany. In 1943, and at the height of the war, the Third Reich organized a retrospective of Klimt's paintings. His portraits of Jews, including that of Adele Bloch-Bauer, were stripped of their provenance, and their subjects became generic descriptions of the wealth and the status of a bygone era. Although he had courted many Jewish patrons rather actively during his lifetime, Klimt's art escaped the unfortunate fate of so many of these same patrons during the Second World War, and was therefore destined to live on.
But let us come back to The Hare with Amber Eyes. The author gives us quite a detailed account of the items that the family managed to retrieve, mostly through his grandmother Elizabeth's efforts. He writes, "Elizabeth wrote letter after letter against the backdrop of failing expectations. She wrote partly from anger at the way in which pseudo-legalistic measures were put up to dissuade claimants. She was a lawyer after all. But mostly she tried hard because all four siblings were in real financial need and she was the only one living in Europe." Whenever she managed to retrieve an item, it was sold and the money was split. She kept the family connected, forwarding photos and letters. After the war, Henk started a good job in London, working for the UN Relief Association, and they were more comfortably off. But Gisela in Mexico had hard times, even working as a cleaner to support her family. Five years after the war, the Palais Efrussi was returned to Elizabeth. It was not a good time to sell a war-damaged palais in a city under the control of four occupation armies. It raised a meager $30,000. After that, Elizabeth just gave up. By 1952, Herr Steinhauser, Victor's former business partner, had become head of the Austrian Association of Bankers. He was asked if he knew anything of the Efrussi Bank before it had been Aryanized, as in 1953 it would have been 100 years since the bank was founded. He flatly replied he knew nothing and said that the centenary would not be celebrated. Thus, the 100 years since Efrussi had moved from Odessa to Vienna just went unnoticed and uncelebrated. Over, Iggy was demobbed and was living in Virginia. His battle experiences had put an end to his life in the world of fashion. In an unintentional return to the family trade, he now worked for Bunge, an international grain dealer. Towards the end of 1947, he travelled to England to visit his sister, Henk, and the boys. For the first time, he visits his father's grave in Tunbridge Wells. It is a turning point in his life. He has to decide to move to a new placing, either in Uganda or in Japan. On this occasion, Elizabeth opens the attaché case, and together the siblings handle those figurines, the netsuke, the platings of their childhood. The monkey wrapped around the gourd, the hare with amber eyes. They had last looked at these intricate objects together in their mother's dressing room 30 years before. Rediscovering them gives the siblings a poignant sense of loss. Iggy takes a quick decision about his future. It's Japan. I'll take them back, he says. Next week, we shall see the return of the 264 Netsuke to the country of their origin, Japan. And thank you to Caroline Mijani for her contribution.